right. It's been a while since I've done that, so it was a different experience. I believe I'd much rather speak to a large number of adults than just a few children. Just a little bit about us as we begin. My wife Diane is over there. If I won't make her stand up, she's going to raise her hand over there. If you were here in 1986, was anybody around in 1986? That summer, we were headed to the mission field in the Congo, and we came and we did your VBS that many years ago. So we are not new to this area. We've been here before, so we're glad to be back. We're glad to give Matthew a break. He may look a little tired today. I think they're just coming in from last night or yesterday, but you know that if he went to the convention, he's going to be refreshed this week, and he's going to be rip-raring ready to go next week. So we're happy to be here, happy to give him a break, and happy to be with you all. We've met some new friends who may not have been here that long ago, and we're glad for that. Today, I want to start with a quiz. I love quizzes, and hopefully there are some of you old-timers who'll know the answer to this quiz. If you know the answer, just don't answer out loud. Just say to yourself, mm-hmm, because we'll get to the answer much later this morning. Here's the quiz. Where does the phrase, so rich a crown, come from? So rich a crown. Where does that little phrase come from? Like I said, the old-timers might get that right away. Some of you newer ones might not. So rich a crown. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about crowns this morning. A few minutes to talk about crowns. This last summer, my wife and I were coming back from overseas, and we happened to have a layover in London, England. And so we thought to ourselves, we've never been here before. Let's take one of those bus tours and tour the city and see some of the great sights of London, England. Now, there was a yellow tour, a red tour, and a blue tour, bus tour, and we chose the red tour. Here's what I know about the red tour. They motor you through town. It seems like about 50 miles an hour. You barely get to see anything, and there's one bathroom break the whole day. That's what I remember about the red tour. So that's my tourist advice for you if you're ever in London, England. But one thing I do remember is that we passed by quickly, ever so quickly, but we did pass by the Tower of London, and it's huge. It's a big place. It's like a fortress, and I thought to myself, I want to come back here someday, and I want to stop, and I want to be able to go through the Tower of London. That would just be so neat, because one thing I know about the Tower of London is that the crown jewels are there. The Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth II, God bless her, she's 91 years old now, something like that. She just had her birthday. She has a crown, and it's in with those crown jewels held in the Tower of London. It's the first British crown to be made totally of platinum. I guess that's better than gold. The crown was made by Garrard and Company in London, the long-term manufacturer of British royal crowns. And I know that you've seen the pictures of her in her crown, and you can probably, in your mind, visualize the four half arches that meet high in the middle, and the crown is decorated with precious stones, most notably the 105-carat Koh-i-Noor diamond in the middle of that front cross. This diamond was seized by the East India Company and became part of the British crown jewels when Queen Victoria was proclaimed Empress of India in 1877. It's been around that long. And as hard as I tried and searched on the internet, I could not find anyone who placed an exact value on that crown. But I think we can safely say that with that 105-carat diamond right in the middle and all the other jewels and the platinum, that it's worth millions of dollars. MasterCard would probably say that it's priceless. Why does the Queen have a crown like this? Why have monarchs throughout the centuries worn crowns? Clear back in the Old Testament times, even in the book of Job, which is probably the first book that was ever penned in our Old Testament, way back then, kings wore royal crowns. In Judges chapter 9 and verse 6, as we find Israel becoming a nation, even against God's direct order, it says, "Then all the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo gathered beside the great tree at the pillar in Shechem to crown Abimelech king." Now you can go back and read that story and find out what's happening there in Judges chapter 9. But what I want you to see is way back then in Israel's history, long ago, centuries ago, they were trying to crown somebody as king, place on his head a crown, and make him their leader. In 1 Chronicles chapter 20, starting in verse 2, it says, "David took the crown from the head of their king." Now, the people we're talking about is the Ammonites. So David was a warrior king, and the people were conquering nations around them. They went into the country of Amnon, and they captured the king. And so at this time, it says, "David took the crown from the head of their king. Its weight was found to be a talent, or 75 pounds of gold, and it was set with precious stones, and it was placed on David's head," Chronicles tells us. So you got the picture there. The Israelites go in, they conquer Amnon, and the Ammonites are made subject to them. The king, they bring in this king. They take the crown from his head, and it's placed on David, all 75 pounds of it. So you can imagine David, he's about to fall over, because you try it. Put 75 pounds on your head this afternoon and see what happens to you. But he's got all this great, whatever it looked like, he's got this great gold crown on his head. It also says he took a great quantity of plunder from the city. Also, if you remember Esther, the story of Esther, you can read that in the book that's entitled by her name, Esther, right off the bat in chapter, I believe it's in chapter 2, it shows that Queen Esther was crowned. A crown was placed on her head. And Vashti was out, and now she was the queen. She was made one of the rulers, the king's wife, and the crown was placed on her head. So when power comes to one person, they become king or queen, a crown is placed on their head. The crown identifies the wearer as someone very special. So here we're in the presence of this person, and we look and we see something's different about them. They've got this gold encrusted crown on their head. What is it? What does that mean? It means that they're king or they're queen. It means something. It sets them apart. In the case of the king, it marks them as the sovereign ruler of a people or a country. It sets them apart. They are special. Not just any old Joe could obtain or wear a crown. Anyone long ago could wear a turban or a shawl on their head. Long ago, you know, any old Joe could go down the street and he's got a turban on, or he's just got this cloth over his head. Anyone in England can wear a ball cap or a derby, but only the king or queen gets to wear the jewel-encrusted crown. The crown sets them apart. It's their identity. It marks them. The royal crown marks someone as royalty. They are sovereign. They are the leader. Now, before we continue talking about crowns, I got 3 points this morning that I want you to learn, and I want you to walk away here with as we continue our talk, as we continue the discussion. I want to review a couple of important truths. These are truths. They're very simple, and you can get them. And I want to make sure that we're on the same page, and we will learn this all together as long as it takes. So if we have to be here till 1 or 2 o'clock this afternoon, then until you get it, we'll do that. And so there's going to be 3. The first one, I'm not going to sum it up or give you the point until the very end. The last 2, I'll give you the point in the beginning, and we're learning them together. But hold on for this first point now. And we'll summarize at the end, and then we'll all repeat it together. First, here's the first thing, and we're going to build to it. Adam and Eve listened to Satan in the garden. You remember that story way back in Genesis. They ate the fruit that God forbade them to eat. God said, don't eat this fruit. They ate it. They sinned. And then it brought on God's curse. Because of the sin, God said, you are cursed. Satan was cursed. The woman was cursed with pain in childbirth and then the desire for her husband. And then in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 7, it says this. To Adam, he said, to Adam, God said, because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground. So that was the curse for Adam, and it was passed on as the curse for all of us. Adam followed Eve. He ate of the fruit, and God said, here's the curse. The curse was that there would be thorns, that he would have to toil, and life would be painful for him. So there was sin, and because of his sin, there were thorns until the time of his death. Sin, thorns. Because of man's sin, the ground was cursed by God, and it would produce what? Thorns. Thorns. Now, I've got to admit, I read this long ago, and I thought to myself, that's really not a big deal, is it? Now, I've got to confess, I grew up in the city, and we didn't really have much of a problem with thorns. Maybe I got scratched by a rose bush every once in a while, but my life hasn't really been that cursed with thorns. Maybe some of you who've grown up on the farm or around the farm were a little bit more cursed by some thorns and thistles around the property, but I don't believe it was that big of a deal for you. But God is showing here that, yes, it is a big deal. Before the fall, there were no thorns. Sin caused there to be thorns on this earth. Throughout the rest of the Bible, thorns then are associated with sin. They are an ugly and awful thing. Thorns produce pain and suffering, and so does sin. Listen to Proverbs 22:5. Proverbs 22:5. It says, in the path of the wicked are thorns and snares. One more time. In the path of the wicked are thorns and snares. Israel was sinful toward God. In their history, if you read the Old Testament, you'll figure out that they never really would obey God. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is before the people, and he says, you're going to have to obey God. And he gives them the Ten Commandments and all the other laws. And before he leaves them, before he dies, he says, are you going to follow God? Choose this day. And the people say, oh yeah, we're going to follow God. We're going to obey everything that he tells us. Did they do that? Well, they might have for a little while, but it's their history. And the Bible shows us in the Old Testament that over and over they didn't do that. They would disobey. In their sinful nature, they really couldn't fully obey God. The nation spiraled downward and downward throughout the book of Isaiah. There is a horrible picture of the people and the devastation in their land. You see, in the beginning, they came into the promised land. They came into the land of Canaan, and you remember it was a land flowing with milk and honey, as it was first described. It had vineyards, and everything was set up for them. It was ready. They just had to walk in and take it, and they did, and everything was great and peachy and hunky-dory in the beginning. God gave them this great fruitful land, but they continued to sin. And if you read the book of Isaiah, you'll see that basically God is taking away that wonderful gift to them. He's taking it away. And things get worse and worse and worse. Their land starts to go down the physical state of the land. Listen to Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 6. Isaiah 5 and verse 6. God says, about the nation of Israel and the people of Judah, both north and south then, I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. People are very sinful. So God says, this is exactly what's going to happen. Your land, which was so fruitful, so wonderful in the beginning, here's how I have to punish you then. There's going to be what? There's going to be thorns. There's going to be thorns and briars. And we begin to see the country getting overrun. Listen to Isaiah 7:23. Isaiah 7:23 through 25. In that day, in every place, get that now, in every place where there was a thousand vines worth a thousand silver shekels, there will be only briars and thorns. Hunters will go there with bow and arrow, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. As for all the hills once cultivated by the hoe, you will no longer go there for fear of the briars and thorns. So you're getting that three times in just a few verses. He repeats that. God repeats it. Thorns and briars. Thorns and briars. Thorns and briars. You had this wonderful land, but because of your sin, God says, I got to take that away. So he gives this picture of a couple of hunters going out. They've got their bows. They're ready to bag that deer or whatever the hunters would do in that day. And they got their bows, and they're walking, and they think, boy, it used to be easy hunting here, but now there's so many thorns. There's so many briars. There's so many thistles. It's making it really impossible for us to do this anymore. A land which was so wonderful for the people, God is taking away. And then at some point, God would totally take that away. But so what we're seeing is where there's sin, in the Old Testament, where there's sin, there's thorns. Where there's sin, there's thorns. Where there's thorns, you know that there's some sin in the people's life. Where there is sin, there is thorns. Where there's sin, there's thorns. So that's the first one. Where there's sin, there's thorns. You're getting it. Somebody's awake here. That's great. Where there's sin, there's thorns. That's point number one. Where there's sin, there's thorns. You can reverse it too, just very easily. Where there's thorns, there's sin. Where there's thorns, there's sin. There's an association. There's a link there. The two go together, God was showing in the Old Testament. Your country is overrun with thorns, so there's got to be sin. He promised it in the garden, and it was true all the way through. So that's point number one. We got two more points to go. I promise you, they're so much shorter. They're so much shorter. So much shorter, the first one's just very short. Or the second one's very short. Here's the next one. God teaches us sometimes with pictures. God teaches us sometimes with pictures. A lot of times he tells us, when we have to read, what God's saying, but a lot of times he just shows us. God teaches with pictures. You remember in the Old Testament, there's the temple. And if you look back in the book of, I think, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, around there, God's spelling out the laws for the temple and the laws for the priests and the sacrifices that go with that. And the temple has to be so high and has to be so wide. It has all this stuff. It has the mercy seat, and it has the Holy of Holies, and there's a curtain, and there's the altar of incense, and there's an outer court, an inner court, and the priest has to wear such and such a garb, and it has to have tassels, and he has to have this on his head, and he has to do this and do that, and there's this sacrifice for this sin, and there's that sacrifice for that sin. There's just all kinds of this stuff. The people had to know it all, and they had to do it all. We read the book of Hebrews and we find out, you know what? It was all just God teaching through pictures. It was all just to show the people one thing. It was to show them Jesus. Well, that's just all simple to say, sometimes God teaches through pictures. Sometimes he has to show us something. He has to show us. So, very simply, that's the second thing. Number one, where there's thorns, there's sin. I reversed it on you. Where there's sin, there's thorns. That's all point number one. Here's the second one. God teaches us with pictures. God teaches with pictures. Here's number three. Nothing in God's plan happens by accident. Nothing in God's plan happens by accident. And that's especially true for the crucifixion. What happened there was God's plan. I don't believe that a fly flew across the room that it wasn't God's plan for that time. Nothing was a surprise when Jesus was crucified. Nothing happened by accident. In fact, he'd been telling the disciples over and over and over again, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to the cross, I'm going to die on a cross, I'm going to be lifted up. God knew what was going on, and it was not an accident. Even in man's sinful and wicked deeds, the deeds of Pilate and the deeds of the Jews, what was going on there? God was moving to bring sinful man back to himself. He was moving to save us. He was moving to forgive us of our sins through Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Nothing in God's plan happens by accident. That's what we need to know. And that's number three. So let's review it together. Nothing in God's plan happens by, let's do them all. Where there's sin, there's thorns. God teaches us through nothing in God's plan happens by accident. Okay, we're going to get out of here before 1 o'clock, I think, because you've got them down. So then, where are we going with this? Where are we going? We were talking about crowns, and we got sidetracked here somehow. John 19. I want, if you got a Bible, turn to it. John 19. In the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Just the first couple of paragraphs. John 19:1. I think you've heard this before. I think. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns. Can you let that sink in? And put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. And they struck him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis of charge against him. When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, Here's the man. Here is the man. You know, I got to be honest with you again. You know, years ago I thought, curse of the thorns. Didn't seem like much of a curse to me. And then I read this passage, crown of thorns. You know, you can see it in that picture. I know that didn't kill Jesus. I know it would hurt. Something terrible. And I know I wouldn't want it to happen to me, but you know, that wasn't what did him in the end. I know it was the nails in his hands and feet, and I know that, and him being on, I know that's what Jesus died of in the end. So what about the crown of thorns? Let me read you the poem that is a children's song that's sometimes sung at Christmas. How should a king come? How should a king come? Even a child knows the answer, of course. In a coach of gold with a pure white horse. In the beautiful city, in the prime of day, and the trumpets should cry and the crowds make way, and the flags fly high in the morning sun, and the people all cheer for the sovereign one, And everyone knows that's the way it's done. That's the way that a king should come. How should a king come? Even a commoner understands he should come for his treasures and his houses and lands. He should dine upon summer strawberries and milk and sleep upon bedclothes of satin and silk. And high on a hill his castle should glow. The king should come. The king should come with a crown of glorious gold. The king should come with a crown worth millions and millions and millions. This is our king before Pilate and before the crowd. And this king should come with a crown of glorious gold. Yes, worth millions. This is our king. This is our king. He's the eternal word. He's the heir of all things. He's the image of the heavenly Father. This is the Almighty. This is the ruler of cherubim and angels. This is the sovereign one over every principality and power. Yes, he should wear the glorious, the most glorious crown ever conceived, much greater than that of the Queen of England. But he is a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, as Isaiah tells us. He wears a crown of thorns. Crown of thorns. He is adorned. He is crowned with sin. Where there's thorns, there's thins. Sin. The Roman guards have placed it on his head to mock him. They treat him as a felon. He's made the object of their comedy. They insult him as a mimic monarch. But remember, in God's plan, it's not an accident. It didn't just happen. Sometimes God teaches us with pictures. Yes, he wears the crown of thorns. At this very time, they are mocking him. He could have called 10,000 angels to come and rescue him. Wait, we know he, as creator, could wipe them out with one little word of his own. So can't we see? Can't we see? Do we remember the association between thorns and sin? He wears the crown of thorns. He's adorned. He is identified with our sin. On that day, Jesus bore our sin. Paul tells us that he became sin for us. We are guilty. We should really wear the crown of sin. We deserve to be forever marked and identified with sin. But he has become our substitute. Thorns are the coronation of sin. And now Christ has taken away its crown, our crown, and put it on his own head. What is the best crown that Jesus could wear? I don't know about you, but I'm glad it's not that one worth millions and millions of dollars held up in London, England, locked away in that Tower of London. The best crown is the one he wore on my behalf. It was the crown woven with thorns that was placed on his brow, which spilled the precious blood that was shed to save me from my sin. So rich a crown. So rich a crown. Where does that come from? It's an old hymn. When I survey the wondrous cross, on which the Prince of Glory died. My richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride. See from his head, his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love or sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown? So rich a crown. It was on Jesus' head. It was made of thorns. I want to go on with that old hymn. The last verse. We have to say, Jesus wore the crown for me. It was my sin that he bore. So what? Well, that old hymn goes on to ask, love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. There's another old hymn older than that, but I love how it ends. It says, by and by, when I look on his face, beautiful the face, thorn-shadowed face, by and by, when I look on his face, I'd wish I'd given him more. Now, as you look at the crown, don't you wish you could give him more? Father in heaven, how glorious, how marvelous. That branch of thorns which was woven together and thrust down on your head. Because we know thorns means there was sin there. You teach us with pictures. And we know it wasn't an accident. What you were showing us, Christ taking our sin to the cross. Christ bearing our sin. Christ becoming sin for us and giving us his own righteousness so that we can stand before you someday clean and pure and holy, and we'll be able to come into heaven. Thank you, Lord. We praise you. We thank you for that crown. In Jesus' name. Our hymn of invitation, number 300. What a great time to say, each of us, in our own words, I've decided to follow Jesus. We need to say that every day, every week. I've decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back. And the invitation is always open for those outside of Christ. If you're not following the one who bore your sin on the cross, you're still being your sin. So we invite you to come. Give your life to him, the one who bore your sin, and that your sin may be forgiven. Now's the time. Let's all sing.